Greetings and welcome to Season 1, Episode 7 of That's What I Think, But I Could Be Wrong, Conspiracy Theories That Turned Out to Be True. My name is Todd Lorenz, and this is my show. I drop a new episode every Thursday, first thing in the morning. I think cryptids exist that science should recognize. I don't think Lee Harvey Oswald had a thing to do with the murder of John F. Kennedy. I don't think we know the truth about what happened on 9/11. I think the United States should meddle in foreign affairs as little as possible. And I believe the vast majority of politicians are corrupt. But hey, that's just what I think. And I could be wrong.
That's what I think, but I could be wrong. That's what I thought when I wrote this song. I say what I believe and I say it's strong. That's what I think, but I could be wrong.
Hey there, thanks for listening, thanks for streaming, thanks for downloading, thanks for consuming on the media of your choice. If you have not given me a positive rating or review, please do so. It will help me grow the show, and that's important to me. The show notes and references for each episode can be found on my website, toddlorenz.com, where you'll also find all of my music. Now then, the topic this week, I thought I'd present a sort of primer on conspiracy theories, rather than focus on any one given subject. In the future, I may present a single show devoted to any one of these topics, but for now, I thought I'd just cover some of the basics. Let's start with what exactly is a conspiracy theory. Well, a trip to Merriam-Webster.com gives us the following definition: a theory that explains an event or set of circumstances as the result of a secret plot by usually powerful conspirators. Okay, yeah, I'll take that. However, Wiktionary provides some notes that might give us a better understanding of what is implied when someone labels an idea as a conspiracy theory. The phrase conspiracy theory is sometimes used in an attempt to imply that hypothetical speculation is not worthy of serious consideration, usually with phrasing indicative of dismissal. Some consider it inappropriate to use the phrase conspiracy theory in an attempt to dismissively discredit hypothetical speculation in any form. Essentially, if you say that you believe in any given conspiracy theory, there are those who automatically think you're some kind of kook who wears tinfoil hats to prevent the aliens from reading your brain, or something along those lines. The problem, though, is this. There have been events in the world that were once considered conspiracies or laughable that turned out to be true, and I'm going to cover some of them. Let's start with what may be the granddaddy of all conspiracy theories: the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Kennedy was elected as the 35th President of the United States and served from January 1961 until his assassination on November 22, 1963. On November 29, 1963, just 7 days after Lyndon Johnson became president, he issued Executive Order No. 11130, which set up a Blue Ribbon Commission headed by Chief Justice Earl Warren to investigate each and every aspect of the national tragedy. They eventually issued the Warren Commission report, which concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. He was not part of any conspiracy, foreign or domestic, and they found no evidence that anyone assisted Oswald in planning or carrying out the assassination. And that's what most of the country knows. That's what we're taught. However, there is one small problem with that. Did you know that an official governmental body investigated the assassination again and released a report in 1979? The report of the Select Committee on Assassinations of the United States House of Representatives includes the following. In conclusion, the committee found that the scientific acoustical evidence established a high probability that two gunmen fired at President John F. Kennedy. They also found that the Secret Service possessed information that was not properly analyzed, investigated, or used by the Secret Service in connection with the president's trip to Dallas, where he was assassinated. the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, failed to investigate adequately the possibility of a conspiracy to assassinate the president. The FBI was deficient in its sharing of information with other agencies and departments. The Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, was deficient in its collection and sharing of information both prior to and subsequent to the assassination. And the Warren Commission failed to investigate adequately the possibility of a conspiracy to assassinate the president. That's pretty damning, isn't it? And that comes from a government investigation. Yet we don't really hear a lot about that. Now, the report ultimately may be flawed. The acoustic evidence they used to establish a high probability of two gunmen firing at the president has been called into question and perhaps found wanting. The National Academy of Sciences conducted its own analysis of the tape and concluded that the House report was a crock. According to them, it turned out that some of the four gunshot-like sounds were not gunshots, and that some of the sounds on the tape or shots on the tape occurred a minute after the assassination. But some question their findings. Even if the acoustic evidence that the Select Committee on Assassinations used to come to their conclusion is faulty, even if they're wrong about it, it doesn't change their other findings, that essentially the Secret Service, FBI, and CIA all failed, and that the Warren Commission itself did not investigate adequately. So one could say that it is true that one governmental body found that Oswald acted alone, while another found that there was at least one other shooter. Both reports are apparently flawed. Now then, let's talk about the Gulf of Tonkin incident. On August 4th, 1964, two American destroyers, the USS Turner Joy and the USS Maddox, reported that they had been attacked by three North Vietnamese gunboats. Within 30 minutes, President Lyndon Johnson made the decision to retaliate, using the attack as justification for the invasion of North Vietnam. History calls the results of this decision the Vietnam War, and statistics indicate that because of the war, both sides suffered a total of 1.475 million military casualties, 2.094 million wounded, and 4 million civilian casualties. All in the name of a war justified by a lie. An article published by the New York Times on December 2nd, 2005, discusses documents released by the National Security Agency, or NSA, and includes the following revelation. The overwhelming body of reports, if used, would have told the story that no attack had happened, so a conscious effort ensued to demonstrate that an attack occurred. A lot of people at the agency haven't been happy that the communications intelligence was used to support a wrong decision. It's not the first time a false flag or false information has been used to start a war. Certainly won't be the last. Most recent is what? I would guess Iraq, where Saddam Hussein supposedly had weapons of mass destruction. Never found them, did we? It also took our government quite a while to find the Mafia. Today, the existence of La Cosa Nostra is a given, and some of our best entertainment is based on the organization's activities. The Godfather, Goodfellas, The Sopranos, The Untouchables, and Casino are just a few examples. But prior to the 1950s, the government's stance was that the Mafia was a myth. They weren't real. They were a conspiracy theory. The first real knowledge we, the people, received came in the form of New York mobster Joseph Valachi. In 1963, he broke the Mafia's code of silence, became an informant, and gave the world details on how the Mafia worked that had never been heard before. So, we had a highly profitable and powerful criminal organization that not only managed to go largely undetected, it also had the United States government publicly proclaiming it didn't exist. How's that for influential? How's that for a conspiracy theory that became conspiracy fact? One of the arguments people often make against a conspiracy theory is that it requires too many people to remain silent, to keep the secret. Well, the Mafia managed it, at least as far as our government was concerned. So did our next topic, the Manhattan Project. That was the code name for the American-led effort to develop a functional atomic weapon during World War II. The creation and eventual use of the bomb engaged some of the world's leading scientific minds, as well as the United States military, and most of the work was done in Los Alamos, New Mexico, not the borough of New York City for which it was named originally. The project was started in response to fears that German scientists had been working on a weapon using nuclear technology since the 1930s, and that Adolf Hitler was prepared to use it. Now, my point with the Manhattan Project is not so much that it was done or whether or not it was moral or necessary. It's the number of people that were involved and the fact that the secret was kept. Or at least that's what history would like us to believe. Some sources state that the project grew to employ up to 130,000 people, and I've seen a paper saying the number was as high as 200,000. And I also found an article that puts the number much higher at around 485,000 people. How did so many manage to keep the secret? Well, of course, they were sworn to secrecy, and the work was compartmentalized, meaning different departments didn't know what the end product would be. Each had their own specific job to finish. Now, while the Office of Censorship once said that the Manhattan Project was the, quote, best-kept single secret of the war, end quote, there are those who debate that. I found an article that states it was the biggest open secret in Washington, and the article also covers a report that appeared in the Cleveland Press, and there were other leaks to the press. But ultimately, the bottom line, it was a surprise to the enemy. That's the key. Couldn't have been that big an open secret if they didn't know it was coming. So a large secret, possibly involving hundreds of thousands of people, can be kept. History tells us so. The examples we've discussed so far involved either organized crime, or the government keeping secrets during a time of war, or, in the case of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, a desire perhaps to begin a war. Some people believe our government would never purposefully harm its citizens unless it was for some kind of greater good, and any statement to the contrary is a lie at best and treasonous at worst. However, the U.S. Public Health Service withheld treatment from 399 black men infected with syphilis for 40 years. The Public Health Service and the Tuskegee Institute started the study in 1932. The men in question were lied to about the disease they had, and even when penicillin became a standard cure, treatment was withheld. Why? The study was conducted to determine from autopsies what the disease does to the human body. Consider that for a moment. A group of people decided that letting 399 men die from a disease even after a cure was discovered, was acceptable. This directly affected not just the men involved, but their wives and children as well. In 1973, a class action lawsuit awarded a $9 million settlement and free health care to the survivors. Additionally, President Clinton issued a 1997 apology, stating, quote, "The United States government did something that was wrong. Deeply, profoundly, morally wrong. It is not only in remembering that shameful past that we can make amends and repair our nation, but it is in remembering that past that we can build a better present and a better future." Now, the apology is nice, and the class action lawsuit is helpful to those who needed the money, but that does nothing to reduce how despicable the whole affair was. How mad would you be if you were one of those men or a member of their families? Now, the Tuskegee syphilis study is an example of a government agency purposefully harming its citizens. And it happened in this country. Well, what about an example of something that was planned or suggested but didn't happen? In the early 1960s, America's top military leaders reportedly drafted plans to kill innocent people and commit acts of terrorism in U.S. cities to create public support for a war against Cuba. Codenamed Operation Northwoods, the plans reportedly included the possible assassination of Cuban immigrants, sinking boats of Cuban refugees on the high seas, hijacking planes, blowing up a U.S. ship, and even orchestrating violent terrorism in U.S. cities. Huh, that sound anything like what happened on 9/11? The plans were developed as ways to trick the American public and the international community into supporting a war to oust Cuba's then new leader, communist Fidel Castro. America's top military brass considered causing U.S. military casualties, writing, quote, "We could blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba," end quote, and, quote, "casualty lists in U.S. newspapers would cause a helpful wave of national indignation," end quote. Yeah, compare that to the wave of patriotism that happened immediately after 9/11. Details of the plans are described in Body of Secrets, a new book by investigative reporter James Bamford about the history of America's largest spy agency, the National Security Agency. However, the plans were not connected to the agency. The plans had the written approval of all the Joint Chiefs of Staff and were presented to President Kennedy's Defense Secretary, Robert McNamara, in March 1962. But they were rejected by the civilian leadership and have gone undisclosed for nearly 40 years. The documents show the Joint Chiefs of Staff drew up and approved plans for what may be the most corrupt plan ever created by the U.S. government. The Joint Chiefs even proposed using the potential death of astronaut John Glenn during the first attempt to put an American into orbit as a false pretext for war with Cuba. Should the rocket explode and kill Glenn, the objective is to provide irrevocable proof that the fault lies with the communists, meaning Cuba. The plans were motivated by an intense desire among senior military leaders to depose Castro, who seized power in 1959 to become the first communist leader in the Western Hemisphere, only 90 miles from U.S. shores. Ironically, the documents came to light in part because of the 1992 Oliver Stone film JFK, which examined the possibility of a conspiracy behind the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, the reporter who wrote the book, James Bamford, finishes the article by saying, quote, "The scary thing is none of this stuff comes out until 40 years after," end quote. I agree. What will we know 40 years from now about some of the nasty stuff happening today and recently? I don't expect to be around to see it, but maybe my podcast will live on in infamy. So Operation Northwoods was a proposed false flag operation. We go from that to using public relations to sell a war. The following is from an article titled, October 10, 1990, False Allegation of Iraqi Depredations Against Kuwaiti Children in Flames, Public Opinion. An unconfirmed report of Iraqi soldiers entering a Kuwaiti hospital during the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and removing newborns from their incubators caused a sensation in the U.S. media. The rumor, which later turns out to be false, is seized upon by senior executives of the PR firm Hill & Knowlton, which has a $11.9 million contract from the Kuwaiti royal family to win support for a U.S.-led intervention against Iraq, the largest foreign-funded campaign ever mounted to shape U.S. public opinion. The firm also has close ties to the Bush administration and will assist in marketing the war to the U.S. citizenry. Hill & Knowlton uses a front group, Citizens for a Free Kuwait, to plant the stories in the news media. Hearings on the story and other tales of Iraqi atrocities are convened by the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. Reporters John Stauber and Sheldon Rampton will later characterize the caucus as little more than a Hill and Knowlton-funded sham. The star of the hearings is a slender 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl called Naira. According to the caucus, her true identity is being concealed to prevent Iraqi reprisals against her or her family. Sobbing throughout her testimony, Naira describes what she says she witnessed in a hospital in Kuwait City. Her written testimony is provided to reporters and congressmen in a media kit prepared by Citizens for a Free Kuwait. Quote, I volunteered at the Al-Adan Hospital. While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns and go into the room where babies were in incubators. They took the babies out of the incubators, took the incubators, and left the babies on the cold floor to die. End quote. The hearings, and particularly Naira's emotional tale, inflamed American public opinion against the Iraqis and helped drum up support for a U.S. invasion of Iraq. Her entire testimony is a lie. Naira is the daughter of Saad Nasir al-Saban, the Kuwaiti ambassador to the U.S., and her testimony was coached by Hill and Knowlton's vice president. Seven other witnesses testified to the same atrocities. They all use false names and identities. No journalist investigates the claims. It is not until after the war that human rights investigators look into the charges. No other witnesses can be located to confirm Naira's story. Dr. Mohammed Matar, director of Kuwait's primary care system, and his wife, Dr. Fayeza Youssef, who runs the obstetrics unit at the maternity hospital, says that at the time of the so-called atrocities, few, if any, babies were in incubator units, and Kuwait only possesses a few such units anyway. It is doubtful that Naira was even in the country at the time. Amnesty International supported the story but issued a retraction, and Naira herself will later admit she had never been in the hospital, but learned of the supposed baby murders from a friend. So there you have it. A rumor turned to lies, turned to PR, used to sell a war. How's that for conspiracy fact? Now then, the last thing I'm going to discuss is called the business plot, and it involves a gentleman named Major General Smedley Darlington Butler. Kind of an unusual, even funny name, but trust me, you wouldn't say that to him. He was a United States Marine Corps Major General, which was the highest rank authorized at that time. When he died, he was the most decorated Marine in U.S. history. During his 34-year career as a Marine, he participated in military actions in the Philippines, China, Central America, and the Caribbean during the Banana Wars, and France in World War I. By the end of his career, Butler had received 16 medals, 5 for heroism. He is one of 19 men to receive the Medal of Honor twice, one of 3 to be awarded both the Marine Corps Brevet Medal and the Medal of Honor, and the only Marine to be awarded the Brevet Medal and 2 Medals of Honor, all for separate actions. So this guy was a legitimate hero and obviously a badass. Okay? He has the cred. So what does he have to do with something called a business plot? Well, some explanation is required, but I will try to be brief. The business plot was a conspiracy to overthrow President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Major General Smedley Butler exposed the attempted coup d'etat in 1934. It involved some of the wealthiest businessmen in the U.S. Now, Butler testified before a congressional committee and laid out an amazing saga, detailing how the conspirators attempted to recruit him. Now, the U.S. businessmen who were behind it sought to preserve their wealth and power. Businessmen like Henry Ford, John D. Rockefeller, John and Alan Dulles, Prescott Bush, and George Herbert Walker were said to have admired Hitler and Mussolini, because while they did so at the point of the gun, fascists used a strong hand protecting business. They were ruthless dealing with labor unions and social unrest, and that's what those men wanted in the U.S. Now, the Great Depression brought thousands of World War I veterans to Washington, D.C. on July 17, 1932. They pitched tents around the city and demanded payment of bonuses granted to them under the Adjusted Service Certificate Law of 1924. General Butler encouraged them to fight Hoover as though he was the Kaiser to get what they deserved. Hoover refused to meet with them and ordered the U.S. cavalry to remove them and their campsites. Even though he was Republican, General Butler threw his support to Roosevelt for president. Now, by the end of Roosevelt's first 100 days, America's richest businessmen were panicking. They thought Roosevelt would conduct a massive redistribution of wealth from the rich to the poor. Now, I think it's important to note a couple of things here. First, Roosevelt was seen by many as a socialist in his time, so it's not surprising that those who had wealth and power were afraid that he was going to conduct a redistribution of wealth. It makes sense to me. It's also important to note how popular General Butler was with the troops. He had sway with them, just as he had influence over those who came into Washington and camped out trying to get benefits they were owed. Butler's testimony described a plot only powerful men with money could design. First, they planned to create a fascist army, like Italy's black shirts and Germany's brown shirts, for Butler to lead. Now, the man who approached Butler on behalf of the nation's elite was named Gerald Maguire. Maguire claimed to have 500,000 war veterans from the American Legion, and each man was a leader of 10 others, which gave a total of 5 million men if needed. They said a second fascist army was to be recruited from the Civilian Conservation Corps and financed with $700 million. Arms and equipment would be obtained from the Remington Arms Company and supplied by the DuPont family. Now, with that manpower, Wall Street plotters wanted General Butler to deliver an ultimatum demanding either Roosevelt pretend to be incapacitated by polio and allow Butler to take over, or be forced out with the army of 500,000 war veterans from the American Legion. According to Maguire, money was no object. He provided a bank account with $100,000 and told Butler that his Wall Street backers had $300 million if necessary. All this sounds too ridiculous to be true, doesn't it? But money talks. It's always been that way. Those who have wealth often have power. But, as it turned out, Butler wasn't for sale and was a true hero and patriot. As I said, he testified before a congressional committee. The, quote, committee was able to verify all the pertinent statements by General Butler, with the exception of the direct statements suggesting the creation of the organization, end quote. Ultimately, the consensus of the committee was that General Butler was telling the truth about the existence of a plot to overthrow President Franklin D. Roosevelt. And while no persons were named in their report, and the issue of ultimate culpability is ignored, the report makes no attempt to downplay or diminish the threat of such a plot. So there you have it, an actual plot to overthrow a president on our own soil. And in the end, those with the purse strings were not named in the report. Major Butler also wrote a book called War is a Racket, and it's very short. It's really kind of a long pamphlet where he details all the work he did that he ultimately discovered was at the behest of corporate interests, and he discusses war profiteering, and he comes down on the side of all war is a racket. It's all about making money. It's an interesting read, and it's very quick. I will include a link to the text in my show notes page. I strongly suggest you read it. That's it for now. Time for me to wrap this show up. The title of this week's episode was Conspiracy Theories That Turned Out to Be True. We started with the assassination of a president. One government commission decided it was a lone gunman. A second commission decided, no, there was more than one. There was a second gunman. There was a conspiracy involved. And a lot of the agencies tasked with the protection of the president and investigating the assassination did an inadequate job. Next, we have an incident where a war was started based on a lie. Then we have a criminal organization that was deemed by our government to be a myth, but it turned out to be very real. Then we had a military project that was successfully kept secret until the project was used. We discussed a proposed military operation where United States military leaders wanted to conduct false flag operations to include U.S. casualties in order to go to war with Cuba. We talked about a rumor that morphed into a PR move in order to sell a war. And lastly, we discussed a plot where the financially elite wanted to overthrow President Roosevelt. The point I'm trying to drive home here is that yesterday's conspiracy theory can sometimes turn out to be today's conspiracy fact. Not every crazy idea you hear will turn out to be true, but sometimes there's evidence that comes to light that wasn't available to begin with. And yes, evidence is important. When you have people like David Icke out there who literally believe or literally say that there are shape-shifting reptilians masquerading as our world's leaders who also eat children, that requires proof. And while it makes for an interesting science fiction tale, it isn't something that, as of now, can be believed. But the Gulf of Tonkin incident, the fact that the Mafia exists, the Manhattan Project was successfully kept secret, the Tuskegee syphilis study, Operation Northwoods, and the business plot involving General Smedley Butler, these are all things that are verifiable, that are true, that happened, no matter how much they were initially denied. So does that mean that conspiracy theories we hear now are true? Not necessarily. But maybe in a few years, the idea of crisis actors will have some merit. Maybe the idea that skyscrapers can't come down simply from being struck by a jet plane won't seem so far-fetched. Then again, maybe those ideas will become thoroughly debunked. I don't know for sure. But I'll say this. Solely based on what I've talked about during this episode, nearly any idea, regardless of how crazy it sounds, is worth investigating. But hey, you know what? That's just my opinion, and I could be wrong.
That's what I think, but I could be wrong. That's what I thought when I wrote this song. I say what I believe, and I say it strong. That's what I think, but I could be wrong.
Thank you for listening. I truly appreciate it. And I'd really love a positive review on Apple Podcasts or whatever media you use to get to my show. It'll help me grow the podcast and hopefully monetize it within the reasonably near future. If you did not like the show, well, tell you what, why don't you try another episode? Maybe you'll enjoy it more. I can be reached at podcast@toddlorenz.com. My website is toddlorenz.com. You'll find this show along with all of my music. That brings us to the song of the week. I'm choosing something from my 2014 album titled Hope. The tune is called A Simple Song. The words speak for themselves. Enjoy, and I will talk to you next week.
What does it take to change the world? I'll start with changing myself. What can I do to be a better man? See the good in myself. I'll find inspiration. Try to do no wrong. I'll find inspiration. Just a simple song. Just a simple song. How can I change the world? Don't say it can't be done. The journey starts with a single step. We walk before we run. I'll find inspiration. Living with what I need. I'll find inspiration. With a simple melody, with a simple melody. Can anyone change the world? The world doesn't want to change. It starts with one, it can also end. The cost is measured in pain. I'll find inspiration, doing what I can do. I'll find inspiration with just three chords and the truth. just three chords and the truth with a simple melody, with just a simple song.